First, a word about NetApp. NetApp gives developers common tools across any environment and any cloud. If you have a cloud-first mandate for your new application, then you need to know about the new Microsoft service for the Azure portal built by NetApp. Azure NetApp Files is the only Azure offering that lets you build your Linux file share environment in the cloud without needing a specialist to create the environment for you. Take control of your world with Azure NetApp Files. To read more, including the blog from solution architect Steve Collins, go to blog.netapp.com. That's blog.netapp.com and search for Azure NetApp Files. Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and today I'm talking with Kent Beck. He's an original signer of the Agile Manifesto, the author of the whole Extreme Programming book series, and a great keynote speaker that I've seen all over. Thanks for chatting with me, sir.
Oh, thank you very much, Scott. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you've been around in software for a long time, and I first learned about you when I was applying extreme programming concepts to banking, like 20 years ago, but you're still keeping it fresh. You're coming up with new ways to think about software because you're actually still building software, right? You're not just talking about it, you're doing it.
I do as much of it as I can. I spend a fair amount of my time talking to people who are doing it, but I don't figure I've had my last idea yet.
I appreciate that. I find that when I talk to companies that even though it's 2018 and I've been thinking about and applying the concepts that that you introduced for almost 20 years, that still people aren't convinced that being agile, iterating, doing small commits, like all the stuff we take for granted, they're still debating in the middle part of the 21st century.
Yeah, it's a surprise to me. And there's even a revival of the waterfall, which really shocked me. I thought we killed that monster once and for all, but it turns out that even smart people are seduced by the idea that you just have to figure out exactly what you're going to do and then go do it and then you're done. And it still doesn't work for all the same reasons it didn't work before, but the attractiveness of that as a model hasn't waned. And the fact that it doesn't work doesn't seem to affect that.
It seems like, as we are noticing in the world right now, that a lot of things are driven by fear, that a lot of things in software are driven by fear of the system, right? Like the whole DevOps movement is, well, just don't anger the machine. Like, don't bother it. Like, it works. So we should put together systems by which we could fear our software less.
Well, so that's a fairly negative way to put it. I would say something like, DevOps is aligning authority and responsibility. Hmm. If you can break it, then you need to be the one who fixes it.
I like that. So empowering everyone.
Yes. And certainly part of that is the reduction of fear. Maybe 10 years back, I looked back over my career, said, what does all this add up to? And I realized that my personal mission is to help geeks feel safe in the world. Mm-hmm. Part of that is actually being safe, that is to say, not making changes to software that disrupts other people's lives, and it seems to be a challenge. But there are, as you said, you listed the techniques that that go a long way toward reducing the probability that you're going to make one of those errors.
I like that. I like the way that you flipped what was a negative way of looking at something fear-based and turning it into a good feeling of one of safety and comfort.
Yeah, it's a habit of mine. It didn't come naturally at first, but I've been practicing that for some time. Mm-hmm.
And as you're coming up with these different ways to think about programming and different ways to think about workflow, you've got this great article up on Medium called Test and Commit that then became Test, Commit, or Revert. What's the story there?
Well, for some time now, I've worked where if my tests pass, then I want to make a commit, because the sunk cost fallacy is the programmer's I'm not going to say worst nightmare, but it's definitely in the top 10, where you'll make a change and it doesn't work. So you'll make another change and it still doesn't work. And the more changes you make, the greater the investment you've made in this initial false change you made. Mm-hmm. And so you can go days, weeks, sometimes an entire career of following up on that initial mistake. So I want to make it really cheap to get back to a known state, to fight against that sunk cost fallacy. So every time the tests pass, I want to make a commit. So if there's ever a problem and I feel myself swirling down that drain, I can just revert to that last known green state, and then I can move forward again. So I was showing this to a group in Norway, maybe a month and a half ago. And Admund Strømme was one of the students. He said, well, by symmetry, and I'm a sucker for symmetry, he said, by symmetry, if you commit when the tests pass, you should just revert your changes if the tests fail. Now, I thought, that is a stupid idea. I'm going to hate this because I'm just going to make some little mistake and all the code that I typed is just going to disappear, and that would be horrible. So I hate this idea so much, I need to try it. If you only try good ideas, you end up not making much progress. If you find a bad idea that's cheap to experiment with and it works out, then you've got an awesome idea because nobody's stupid enough to compete with you. So this was definitely one of those. So we gave it a shot for a week and discovered, yes, there is an annoying moment when you think you've made a brilliant change to your code and then poof, it all disappears. But what this test commit revert workflow does is the tests are always green and the incentives are to make smaller changes. So if I need to change two things, I write a new test, I need to change two things in order to get that test to pass, I have a strong incentive to figure out some way to make one change first in a stable way and then another change afterwards also in a stable way. So TCR, this test commit revert workflow, pushes me to make many smaller changes.
Does it push you to make even more tests than you might ordinarily?
I wouldn't say more tests. I haven't noticed that kind of effect. The main effect is just if I'm going to make a substantial change, like three whole lines of code at once, I really want to find some way to change two of those lines first and then one line after that. Because if I type in three whole lines of code and it doesn't pass, then poof, they disappear and I have to figure out what went wrong and type them in again. And I don't like that. So I'm going to press myself really hard. And the surprising thing is it feels so good solving that puzzle. That not just what should the code look like, but how am I going to get to that code in small, safe steps, that the light bulb where you say, oh, I see, I changed the third line first, and then I changed the first two lines, that's a great feeling. And I think a lot of programmers are driven by that feeling when there's some pattern you're looking for, and you find it, and it just feels fantastic.
Interesting. Getting back a little bit at the beginning, when you said the sunk cost fallacy, like people have this idea that they don't want to waste resources, they don't want to waste code, they don't want to waste work. It's fundamentally loss aversion. I don't want to work for an hour, and you're saying I shouldn't work for an hour. I should work for minutes, or I should think
seconds.
A lot harder, seconds even.
Yes. And so the thought goes into the sequencing of the changes in a safe way. There's a greater expense to every step that you take, but there's a lower probability that you're going to do a bunch of work and have to throw it away. And depending on how that trade-off comes out, that will or won't pay off.
I wonder if I would find myself in a kind of an analysis paralysis if I continue this all the way through. It's kind of like ridiculous extreme.
Well, we should just try it out for a little while.
Hmm.
just we'll find some toy project. I don't know. This isn't a challenge to you, but
no, I hate the idea. I'm going to have to try it.
It's an offer, and if you'd like to, we could do a screencast, share a screen, program in this way for an hour, and just see how it feels.
That's a great idea. In fact, I do things like this, fun experiments with real software using the website that this podcast is based on, which has some tests, both regular unit tests and all the way up to Selenium tests as well. So there's a bit of a net there as well.
Oh, nice.
Okay. So test and commit or revert. And how does TDD relate to TCR? Is this an evolution? Is this a partner?
Well, this has been there's been a bit of a kerfuffle on Twitter lately about is this just TDD or something quite different? And people seem to be quite upset about it. And I call it an alternative workflow. Mm-hmm. In the same way that test after is another alternative workflow.
Mm.
You can write a bunch of code and then write tests to cover it in bits and pieces. You can write the tests one at a time, interleaved with the implementation, that's TDD. Mm-hmm. Or you can work in this TCR style where the tests are always green and you work hard to keep that true, because if they're ever not green, whatever changes you made are just going in the bit bucket. I call it an alternative workflow. The incentives absolutely change from TDD. The way that I am pushed to think is in a different direction, in the same way that the way I'm pushed to think when I'm working TDD is those incentives are different than the incentives if I'm going to test after.
Interesting. This makes me think about when people run around and argue about Git workflows, and someone says, oh, no, you use Git flow. And like, no, Linus uses it this way. And they argue about all the little details. The fact is that Git is this platform that we have, and you're welcome to put whatever workflow that makes you happy and makes you feel productive and makes you feel safe on top of that. But to argue that there's one true workflow seems like a waste of keystrokes.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the criticisms of TCR is that if you use Git as your version control system, your commits look very, very different than the commits that you would write if you were in a TDD style or a test after style. You have these many, many teensy weensy commits. I did the first public workshop on TCR last night in San Francisco, and we had a little toy problem, just a Fibonacci. I think the most commits someone had was 25 commits to write maybe 12 lines of code and tests together. So those commits are going to look very different. It doesn't mean I would call it even a little bit of an abuse of Git to do that, but because you're using it in a style that it's not really intended, but it works just fine for it. But you're just going to end up with a different set of commits than you would if you worked with a different workflow that has different incentives.
Well, and wasn't the whole argument that we can squash commits and pretend that none of that ever happened?
Well, you can't. You absolutely can squash commits. The next extension of this idea is something I call limbo, where if you have a bunch of people working on the same code base and they're working in this always green TCR style and they're constantly pushing their changes and then pulling the changes other people have made, you're going to have interleaved sets of these teensy tiny changes. And then the Git commits don't look anything like what they look in a code review merge kind of style, even without branches.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, that's not a criticism. It just says, oh, here's a natural consequence of change. You change the incentives, you get different results. All right.
Well, yeah, it's the gamification of work and programming itself.
Yes.
So then you want the diffs to be as small as possible to presumably remove friction around the things that are all implied once someone makes a diff. Because like I've got two pull requests right now. One's a spelling mistake and one is a completely new feature, but they both require reviews and approvals and workflow.
Right. What I noticed, I was at Facebook for 7 years until early this year, and I watched the engineering team grow from 700 to 5,000 people. And I posed myself the question, what would it take to go to the next order of magnitude of engineers? I looked at all of the overhead created by this asynchronous blocking code review style, this pull request style. And I just don't see the overhead of that grows as the team size grows. And I don't see how that works. At the same time, everybody acknowledges that small diffs are better. So that's where the name Limbo comes from. A friend of mine, Sorov Mohapatra, came up with that name because the Limbo song asks you, how low can you go? Mm-hmm. How small could we make diffs? If you can make diffs teensy tiny and safe, then you don't have to review them beforehand. Doesn't mean they don't get reviewed, but you don't have to, it doesn't have to be a blocker to those diffs being applied in other developer machines and for that matter in production, if they're truly safe. If you can do that, then you open up a brave new style of software collaboration where everybody's making a stream of teensy tiny diffs.
Doesn't that mean that theoretically, if something did go wrong, there would be, you'd spend a lot more time kind of figure out, like playing whack-a-mole with all of these diffs, trying to figure out which one broke the system?
Yeah, potentially. As with all the really powerful ideas, this is clearly impractical and impossible to do, except if you can make it practical, then it becomes really interesting.
Well, and that's the thing, right? Like, it's a totally insane idea until it's like, wow, that's a really great idea. We should all be doing that right away.
Yes, yes. And then it takes another 20 or 30 years for people to actually apply it.
Right. Interesting. Like, you know, there's people try to impose flows, whether they be on large teams or just myself, where someone says, I do pull requests to myself and everyone should do pull requests to myself. Well, I don't know about you, but I personally sometimes just say, oh, I'm going to fix that. I'll commit it directly to master. My tests pass. Boom. I'll publish it right away and it's in production. And, you know, if something went wrong, I'll hit the oh crap button and I'll revert it as soon as I notice something went wrong. And I don't feel bad about that.
No, I don't. Nor do I. Life is too short. You know, as human life is now somewhere in the region of 3 billion seconds, is 92 years. So I've already spent 2/3 of mine, and I don't have time to mess around with overhead that doesn't create value.
So you think that someone should apply this, you said, like to small things. You did the test commit revert as a, you know, pick a small project. It can't hurt to try, right?
Right.
You think Limbo is still too out there for someone to apply to a large team?
I think it would take work and a certain amount of appetite for chaos.
Mm.
You're going to be encountering problems you've never encountered before. And when they show up, you're going to need to first become aware of the problem and then to be prepared to take a step back and solve the problem at its root cause instead of just trying to patch over it. But given the experiments that I've done, I think that it's an idea that could be applied immediately if somebody wanted to give it a shot.
Hey friends, if you're like me and you love your Nintendo Switch, you know, for at home or on the go gaming, and you love podcasts, which I assume you do because you're listening to this one right now, then I have a podcast recommendation for you. Check it out. It's Nintendo Dispatch. Nintendo Dispatch is by my good friend James Montemagno and his longtime friend Michael. They're two complete Nintendo fanboys. Now, each week, James and Michael, they break down the latest Nintendo news, the latest game releases, the happenings, the reviews in the world of Nintendo. They review everything that they've been playing. To subscribe, please go search for Nintendo Dispatch in your podcast app or go directly to NintendoDispatch.com. I love supporting other podcasts, and I would really encourage you to go and support NintendoDispatch.com and maybe tweet about it. What do you think that, if we think about what we very first started the opening of this show, that there are people in 2018 that are still not sold on what we think are ideas 2 decades in the baking. What should they do when they're off thinking about maybe TDD and we're off looking at TCR and Limbo and beyond? Should they just jump over it all, or do they have to go in the linear vector and follow us behind?
What a great question. So one is a question like this, I'm going to have to fall back on first principles. So one of my principles is that everybody's responsible for their own learning. So if somebody came to me and said, what should I do? I'd say, you're going to have to manage this. First, is there a problem? Like maybe working in the style you're working now is just fine for you, just fine for your colleagues, just fine for your company. And you're not one of these crazy people who needs to try the latest and greatest thing, in which case, don't do anything about it. It's not a problem. Don't solve it. Given that you want to try it out, I think there are some steps that consistently help me. Being in as part of a community is helpful. Teaching other people is always helpful with new skills. The only way to get good at describing an idea is to be bad at describing the idea first. And you just have to go through those iterations with a forgiving audience. And eventually your presentation of it will get much, much smoother. The first time I described TCR took me an hour. I can give you the same information now in 10 minutes, but there was no way to predict which parts of that hour were useful and which parts weren't until I'd actually tried it, looked my listener in the eye, saw where they glazed over, saw where I was just wrong, figured out which stories are going to be helpful for people. When's the right time to jump into that example and just show them what to do? So different people are going to learn that in different ways, but community and teaching and just diving in and doing some stuff, those are the strongest techniques that I know to learn quickly.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I find most interesting about all of this, whether it be TCR, Limbo, and beyond, is the that fun question, you know, but does it scale? We've all had that experience where we had several hundred or several thousand or maybe even more tests, and we change one thing, and then we're looking at a screen full of red. And then you start thinking about the Cartesian product of the number of programmers times the number of tests times the number of failed builds. And it just gets overwhelming when we break one test and how they're all dependent on each other. It seems like once I get into a couple of hundred tests, I'm looking at a list of tests, but I'm wondering how they're interrelated and why one went red and that caused another 100 to go red.
Yeah, every time I've been in that situation, I didn't really have a testing problem. I had a design problem. There was some part of the system that wasn't pulled apart into sub-elements in such a way that I could easily compose the elements to get the right answer. Instead, there was an assumption that was spread around. I make one change that changes that assumption, and if that assumption is embodied in some way by many tests, then yeah, I'm going to get a whole bunch of tests breaking. But it's not a testing problem. It's a design problem.
That is really, really helpful. So then if I start bringing more people into that system and they start making tiny changes, they're all going to have that problem as well. I need to solve that design problem before I go and impose a new style of work like Limbo on my team.
Or you could use Limbo to begin making improvements together on the design.
Mm.
So I see there's two barriers to doing a better job of designing software. One is lack of skill or idea. So I've had design problems in software that sit there for a year. I mean, I think my record is 12 years where I just didn't like the way this something was designed, but I just didn't know what else to do. If that's the case, then you do have to find a way of working productively with a design that's not as good as you wish it was. The other part is that habit of rolling your chair back and saying, this is changing one more line of code is not the most effective way to address this problem. I need to say, why is this happening? What is the design that would make this problem just go away entirely? Mm-hmm. And how can I get from where I am now to that new design in small, safe steps that allows me to continue delivering functionality all along the way? That's a hard problem to solve. There's a lot of constraints and it can seem overwhelming, but at some point it's better than the alternative of just writing another line of code and another line of code and throwing in another conditional and adding another case statement and making big messes even bigger.
Interesting. You know, in animation, they'll draw keyframes, and then they would do a thing called onion skinning, where they would do the frame, the interpolation of the frames between the two frames. Mm-hmm. And when you said that, you know, I'm in a certain state, you know, state A, and my software, my design is such that it's in this state. And then I can come up with one part of the problem, which is, all right, I know where I need to go. The part that I just realized you described that's so difficult is the onion skinning. It's the, okay, I've got two keyframes. How do I get from this frame to that frame and have it look fluid and not hurt anyone and bother the viewer?
Yeah, and there is a skill to that, and it's not a skill that we teach or that we study. I call it the succession problem. What is the succession of changes mm-hmm. that lets us get from point A to point B, one, with safety, mm-hmm. and secondarily, as efficiently as possible? The temptation is just start working on that the second state.
Right.
Let me just, you know, and we've all seen that we'll replace the whole system, and then you have Zeno's project management paradox, where the closer you get, the more the target system recedes, and you never actually catch up. So that's the one that's really hard to pull off. Compared to, all right, well, what one thing can I do now that's a little bit more like where I want to go than where I am? And how can I use the information gained in taking that step to take the next step and the next step and the next step? The result of that is going to be kind of messy. You know, so you're going to be in this awkward halfway in between state where maybe you have the old implementation and the new implementation coexisting at the same time. But at least you're making progress towards a state that you know is going to be better. You can continue delivering value as you do it. And you don't have this risk that you think that you get to the new state and discover it's not actually what you wanted.
Mm-hmm. I do talks on being a web developer where I sit down and I theorize, what if I were going to teach someone how to become a web developer today, with the explicit goal that we ignore the last 20 years and nested tables and one pixel GIFs and all the bad things about the web as it grew over the last 20 years. How would you teach us, you know, a 15-year-old or a bunch of high school students about how to make software today? Would you ignore the history, or would you spend a lot of time giving them historical context?
That's a good question. I don't think I have any particular skill at teaching beginners. I think I spend much of my career at Facebook coaching engineers at mm-hmm. all levels, from fairly junior to some of the most senior engineers of Facebook. And I think I have a decent handle on how to help people who are engineers get better. But I'm not the person to walk into a room full of 15-year-olds and say, okay, let's do Hello World.
Right. Well, the reason I ask is that as I enter the downhill, kind of like I pass the hump of my career and going down the other side.
I'd call it the accelerating portion of your career.
Oh, is that what we call it? Right, directly into the grave?
I'm applying that that positivity here, Scott. Downhill. Right. Downhill sounds negative to me. Somehow.
32 feet per second is also pretty negative.
Who doesn't want to accelerate? Now that you're accelerating in your acceleration portion of your career, Scott.
Okay, so now that I'm in the acceleration portion of my career, I'm going back and forth about whether or not I ignore history and try to teach them fresh perspectives and modern techniques, or whether or not, as they say, you know, those that fail to learn history are doomed to repeat it, because you know that you and I will retire and someone will go and invent, you know, extreme programming.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And the waterfall over and over again.
Or Scrummerfall, which is nice.
Watch your mouth out. Yeah, it is going to come around. I'm old enough to have, and I grew up in Silicon Valley and my dad was a programmer, so I'm old enough to have seen some of that history happen. I've always liked knowing the whole stack from the instruction set architecture all the way up. I have a stack of microprocessor manuals in my library. And, you know, and every once in a while, I'll study a new one and be fascinated and interested in it, even though that's not a really, like, how often is that actually useful? I'm not so much. At the same time, I think so much of learning is emotional engagement. Mm. And so if you said, well, before we can let you do, you know, web animations, first we have to study the x86 instruction set manual, you're just going to lose a lot of people. So it doesn't seem like that's going to be a very effective strategy.
Definitely. Well, thank you so much for spending time with me today. I appreciate it.
Oh, Scott, I've heard your voice for many hours, and it's great to get a chance to actually talk to you in person.
That's very kind. So folks can check out Kent Beck at kentbeck.com, and I'm going to include links to everything that we talked about, from Zeno's Paradox all the way up, including Test, Commit, Revert, and Limbo on the Cheap, in the show notes. So I'd encourage you to check those out. This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.